Ask you to take your Bibles this evening, if you would, please, and turn to Genesis 39. Genesis chapter 39, that's page 62. If you're using one of the pew Bibles this evening, and you've probably noticed these last couple Lord's Day evenings, we've turned our attention to Genesis. There's just so much there, and as I've been reading in those portions of Scripture, the Lord has brought these things to my heart that we should consider. So tonight, we're going to be continuing in one sense, in the series that we began this morning, If the Foundations Be Destroyed. And our focus is on the erosion of the moral fabric of our culture. Now, it's certainly not news to say that we live in a culture that is kind of obsessed with sensuality. And of course, sexual immorality isn't something that is unique to our day. But I will say this, when I was a kid, it used to at least be hidden and generally viewed as something that is wrong by our culture. But in our day-to-day, frankly, immoral behavior is blatant, even celebrated, and those who object are seen by the larger culture as just kind of kooky, old-fashioned prudes. And no longer is the portrayal of sexual intimacy limited to, let's say, late night or so-called premium movie channels, but it's in people's faces during prime time, and frankly imbibed by children just as freely as by adults in many cases. So really the fact is the moral integrity of our society isn't just being eroded, it is in many ways collapsing right before our eyes. And the foundations truly are being destroyed. And so we say with David, as we talked about this morning, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And in this particular element, maybe we should ask, what are believers doing? And I'm asking in particular in the context of sensuality and pornography and fornication and adultery. It would be a wonderful thing if Christians were uniformly resisting this moral breakdown, but unfortunately that doesn't seem to be the case. We are being far more influenced by the culture than it seems we're having an influence on the culture. There was a survey done some years back in Christianity Today, and they reported that 1 in 4 self-identified, born-again believers admitted to having committed adultery since the age of 21 as a Christian. In other words, it wasn't, this was before and then I got saved. These are our people who responded to this survey anonymously and indicated that as an adult, as a believer, they were guilty of adultery. 1 in 4. And the number admitting to having done something sexually inappropriate with someone other than their spouse, and I guess that means something short of outright adultery, was closer to 1 in 2. 45% to be exact. And folks, those involved in the survey were all subscribers to Christianity Today, which is a magazine aimed at church leaders within evangelical circles. So this isn't targeting the world at large. This is a publication that targets people who understand the gospel as we do, who identify themselves as Christians, and who frankly are willing to invest money in purchasing an overtly Christian periodical. And 1 in 4 of them say they're guilty of adultery, and nearly half of them say they're guilty of something else. And that's not even going down the pornography route or anything like that. I would imagine those numbers would be yet higher. And sad to say, folks, there aren't many churches in our circles that haven't had an instance where someone in leadership was guilty of some sort of moral failure at some point in the church's, you know, collective memory. And so, you know, you read things like that, you consider things like that, and you almost begin to wonder, is it possible for for people to characteristically be morally pure in our polluted world. And the story of Joseph that we're going to look at here in Genesis 39 says yes. You know, I want you to think about this, okay? And I think probably all of us here are familiar with the account we're going to look at, so we won't read it all, but we'll read parts of it as we work our way through. But this, of course, is the instance where young Joseph is seduced by his boss's wife, and he resists, and he ultimately flees, and he ultimately pays a price for having done right. And so if you think about it, here we have Joseph, a young man reared in a society every bit as morally corrupt as ours, maybe worse, man who had no Bible to read, no church to attend, and frankly, not much good parental training. If this young man, alone in a foreign culture, could resist the direct proposition of his boss's wife, then clearly God can help us resist sexual temptation. And folks, we can be morally pure in a polluted world. We must be, for the sake of God's name and for the sake of our marriages and for the sake of our families and for the sake of our own souls and our own personal walks with Jesus, who died to offer forgiveness and to cleanse us from sin. But I want to suggest to us, folks, that this isn't something that just happens accidentally or automatically. Just because you say you're a Christian doesn't mean that you won't fall prey to the temptation, to the seduction of sensual sin. You don't win wars without knowing your weak enemies, without knowing the enemy's tactics, without having a strategy, without being willing to pay a price. The title of the message tonight is Staying Pure in a Polluted World. Staying pure in a polluted world. So let's begin with prayer. Father, I pray that you would bring the truth of this passage of Scripture home to roost in our hearts tonight. I suspect that even here in our midst are a number, maybe many, who are struggling with sensual sin, maybe pornography. Maybe even physical intimacy with someone other than their spouse. Maybe young people engaged in fornication before they're married. Father, it's easy for us to think that because we're believers and because we take the Bible for what it says, and because we can dress up nice and gather together in a place like this on a regular basis and sing hymns and listen to God's word preached, that must mean that we're going to be okay on this matter. And I pray, Father, that if for those who have not succumbed to these things, that none of us would think it can't happen to us, that we would be fearful of our own flesh, that we would be sensitive to our own carnal desires and realize the dangers that are there, when we would recognize the assault of the devil and the world upon all that is righteous and pure and good. And so I pray, Father, that you would use your word tonight to cause us to be thoughtful and sobered and careful and utterly resolved to live lives of purity despite the filth, the pollution, the corruption all about us. I pray, Father, that you would direct my thoughts and words, that I would speak the truth exactly in the manner you would like me to do. I pray that you'd help us each to focus upon the truth of your word and to allow it to affect us, to confront us, to convict us, and to cause us to change and to grow. And so, Father, we commit this time to you, asking that your Spirit would use your word profitably in our lives this evening. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. So what I want to do is suggest four principles from Genesis 39 that will help us keep ourselves pure in the fallen, filthy, sex-obsessed world that we live in. And so here's the first of those principles, and we'll spend a good bit of time on this one. Be sensitive to situations that make you particularly vulnerable to sensual sin. You know, I hope that I don't need to establish that everyone has the potential to fall in this arena. In 1 Corinthians 10:12, Paul says, "Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." And then he goes on into the next verse to say, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." But what he's saying is, listen, realize that these temptations that affect others will affect you too. They do affect you too. Be honest enough about it. Don't think you're above it. Don't think if maybe because you haven't had a problem in the past, you won't in the future. Beware, be cautious. If you think you stand, you are setting yourself up for a fall. Resist temptation. Flee temptation. Be on the alert for it. That's what he's talking about. He's saying, don't think that it can't happen to you. I don't care how old or how young you are. I don't care if you're a man or a woman. We're all susceptible to temptation through the lusts of the flesh, and in particular, in the matter of sensuality and immorality. I understand that some may struggle more than others. Some may have a certain history that others don't have. I understand the whole aspect of young people growing up and hormonal changes, and there are different elements at play with men and with women. And I understand. I get all that. But the bottom line is no one is immune. So please don't sit here tonight thinking, I hope my husband is listening, or I hope my wife is listening, or I hope my son is listening, or I hope my daughter is listening, or I hope whoever it is, brother so-and-so, sister so-and-so, is getting this. You need to get it. I need to get it. We all need to hear God's word on this important matter and take it to heart in our own lives. No one is immune. Now, having said that, I want to draw our attention here in this first point in particular to the fact that there are certain times, certain circumstances, and certain situations where we're especially vulnerable, more so, let's say, than at other times. So let's take a look here at what's going on in Joseph's life as described in the first six verses. It says, "And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man." I think that's the passage that one of the old Bibles, Tyndale or something like that, translated as, "And he was one lucky fellow," okay? But he was a prosperous man, God being with him. "And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, in Potiphar's sight, and he served him. And Potiphar made Joseph overseer over his house, and all that Potiphar had was put in Joseph's hand." Verse 5, "And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he," that is Potiphar, "left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored." Now, I want you to just think for a minute about the circumstances that this young man finds himself in. So he had been sold to Potiphar, who was the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard, kind of the security chief, if you will, in the palace, so to speak, head of Pharaoh's secret service, you might say. He was also responsible for administering punishment, executing anyone that Pharaoh didn't want around. So suffice it to say, you wouldn't want to get on Potiphar's bad side. And because the Lord was with Joseph, okay, not because Joseph was just such a fabulous guy, though I think he was pretty fabulous, okay, but because the Lord was with Joseph, he did well under Potiphar. He did really well. You know, it's interesting that this passage, the book of Genesis, makes no mention of the struggles that a 17-year-old boy must have gone through upon arriving in Egypt. I mean, he'd been torn from his father, his mother was deceased, he's sold into slavery, he's taken to a strange culture where he couldn't even understand the language. There he's purchased by this powerful man to be a household servant, to be a slave. And yet with God's strength, Joseph obviously adjusted to the situation and flourished. And by the time he's in his mid-20s, Joseph has been put in charge of everything Potiphar owned. Potiphar trusted him so much that he didn't even check up on him. Joseph had the run of the house, the control of the affairs, the power to buy and to sell in Potiphar's name, and the freedom to do so as he deemed best. And he did it. And God blessed and prospered everything that he did. I want you to notice again the end of verse 6, because that really leads into where this passage is going to focus on. It says, Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. Okay, we might read that and say, oh, that means he was a good guy and people liked him. No, that's not what it's saying. You know what it means? It means he was a handsome guy. And not just a little bit. A really good-looking young man. So that sets the stage for the temptation that follows. Satan hits you with temptation when you're most vulnerable. Let's notice some particular vulnerabilities in Joseph's situation. You're vulnerable when you're in a situation where supposedly no one will know. So here you got Joseph, a single man in his 20s, with, I suppose, the normal physiological desires you'd expect of a young man. He was a boy who grew up in the country. Now he's in a sophisticated foreign capital. He's working in a home that was frequented by the rich and famous. He has no old friends who shared his belief in God, no family there, no church friends around to offer him accountability, to appeal to him, to do right. As far as he knew, this tempting situation was private and would never be known to anyone else, except God, of course, but, you know, on the human plane. He sure didn't know that his story was going to be recorded in the world's most read, best-known book. You know, and that's what we're looking at tonight. But in those circumstances, you know, there's a particular vulnerability to temptation when no one's around, when it seems like no one would know. And some of you travel in business, and maybe you find yourself alone in a different city where nobody will know if you give in to sexual temptation. And when you find yourself in that kind of a situation, you need to be especially on guard, doubly on guard. Satan will hit you. He'll hit you hard when you're in a situation where it seems like no one would ever find out. But of course, the Bible warns in Numbers 23 or 32, be sure your sin will find you out. God knows everything, and sin is never private. But the flesh wants to tell us that, you know what? I can do this and no one will know. I can watch this and no one will know. I can engage in this and no one will know. And when you're not surrounded by the natural accountability that comes within a household with family around you in settings that are public and watched, the flesh can get mighty powerful and temptation can seem mighty seductive. You're vulnerable when you're in those situations where it seems that no one will know. You're more vulnerable when you're successful and attractive. Some of us don't have that problem, okay? But you know, some do. Success always opens up new temptations. Verse 7 says that it came to pass after these things But his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." After what things, you ask? Well, after the things that we read earlier, that Joseph was a really effective manager. You know, now we understand that that's all because of God, but Potiphar didn't necessarily know that. Joseph may have told him that, but he probably didn't register that. Potiphar's wife surely didn't realize that, but he just seemed like, man, this must be one really sharp guy. He's got the Midas touch. I mean, every decision he makes, every purchase is a good purchase. Every sale is a good sale. We're making a profit on everything. Everything's working well. The household is just a well-oiled machine. Everybody responds well to his leadership. It's just an amazing thing. He is an amazing guy. Not to mention that he's amazingly good-looking. And it came to pass after these events that Potiphar's wife began to look at Joseph with sensual desire. And I think the text suggests it's not just about the visual, but also about the kind of person that he was. His success, his effectiveness was attractive. Men, ladies, if you're attractive as the world measures attractiveness, be on guard. You know what? There are only three men in the Bible who are described as being good looking. Joseph is one of them, David is another, and Absalom is the third. And two of those three, David and Absalom, both fell to sexual sin, both of them. Only Joseph, the man we're studying here tonight, only Joseph was able to resist that allure of being an attractive person that people have desires towards. So if God has given you good looks, you need to be especially careful. Especially careful in terms of how you dress so as not to be in any way seductive. And men, that's not just for ladies. You know, men have a way of presenting themselves in certain ways to be particularly attractive to women too. And be sure you aren't using your looks to manipulate people, to get things from people, to kind of ingratiate yourself to people. Studies have shown that besides good looks, women are often attracted to men who are financially successful, confident, competent. Men who have power, influence, and public recognition. They're also drawn to men who are compassionate, gentle, and willing to listen. So you can take qualities that are in and of themselves good things, and they can actually set you up for greater temptation. Joseph didn't let his success or his natural attractiveness bring him down, but he could have. Third, you're vulnerable when you're alone with someone who is emotionally needy. And maybe there's a better expression for it, but I think we all kind of get the gist of what I'm saying. Potiphar's wife was a needy lady. Her husband was busy with his important job. You know, the implication of the text is that Potiphar wasn't around too much. And I suppose, you know, some of that is if Pharaoh is traveling, Potiphar's probably with him. There's a lot of things going on in the governance of the country there, and Potiphar has some connection in many of those things. And it seems likely that Potiphar, was a guy who wasn't particularly sensitive to his wife. Because a little bit later on, we're going to see the bitterness that bleeds through when she's blaming her husband for her problem with Joseph. Mrs. Potiphar perhaps felt neglected and wanted attention and wanted intimacy, and not just in the physical sense, but in the personal sense, in the emotional sense, in the relational sense. And she mistakenly thought she could get it through sex outside of marriage with this engaging young man who was around the house a lot. You know, anytime someone of the opposite sex begins sharing, let's say, his or her marriage frustrations with you and suggesting that maybe he or she wishes that his or her spouse was a little bit more kind or a little bit more like you, look out. If you're not careful, you'll begin thinking that person deserves better and that maybe you need to try to help them with it. And that makes you more vulnerable to temptation. Not only are you more vulnerable when you're regularly around someone who is emotionally needy and kind of longing for a relationship, you're obviously more vulnerable if you're emotionally needy. Joseph must have felt kind of lonely. You know, no parents around. His brothers had rejected him. He was a slave without any friends who understood or shared his background. And, you know, it's not an unnatural thing for a young man to desire the companionship of a woman. Given his station in life, it may have seemed like he would never be able to marry someone and have a wife anyway. And maybe Potiphar's wife could have met what he would have rationalized as these pressing needs, but Joseph didn't yield. And folks, let me suggest to you that the sexual temptation is never just physical. Sometimes we kind of categorize, you know, there's this and then there's the physical intimacy part of it. But really it's all wrapped up in the nature of relationships. There's always the good feeling that comes from being desired by somebody else, from having someone interested in you. And God designed marriage and physical intimacy within marriage to meet our needs. If you try to meet those needs outside of marriage, you know, there may be some immediate gratification, I suppose, but it's so destructive. And you'll have long-term pain, and you'll end up enslaved to that sin. If you're married, you need to cultivate companionship with your spouse and don't let emotional distance set in. And if you're single, you know, it's okay to ask God for a spouse. He answers that prayer quite often. In the meantime, focus on serving God and deepen your intimacy with Jesus while maintaining your commitment to moral purity. So the first step to moral purity is to be aware of situations where you're especially vulnerable. And certainly there could be others. And we need to know ourselves and our frailty and our flesh and be mindful of situations and people and circumstances where the vulnerability is increased. That's the first principle. Here's a second principle. Understand how temptation works when it comes to sensual sin. So let's think about the circumstances of our text. You have a needy woman and a vulnerable man in close quarters. And I don't mean vulnerable in the sense of weak, but as all of us are, you know, in a situation that could potentially cause you to yield to that temptation. And let me add that in this case, the man is also a servant of God. He is a believer. He's someone that we know God had great plans for. We, of course, know how things end up, but going way back to his youth, he had these dreams that God had given him, and they were the real deal. And even his parents recognized that there was something unique going on in Joseph's life. So he's a believer. She's not. And folks, when you as a believer find yourself in a tempting situation, Satan is not going to leave you alone. He's more interested in bringing you down than any number of unbelievers. You know, he wants to take those who belong to Christ and see if he can just really destroy our walk with Christ and cause us to give up and say, what's the point in trying to live for God? I failed, and destroy Christian homes and destroy Christian marriages and destroy Christian families. So just by virtue of being a believer, There's a certain amount of extra vulnerability that is there for us. And when that temptation comes, you know, sometimes it's just flattering. I'm guessing that Potiphar's wife had probably dropped some hints before, and you know, of course, Joseph wasn't picking up on them. But now Potiphar's wife hits him head on and says, "Lie with me," in verse 7. Now, we understand she's not asking him to tell some fibs with her, right? He's asking him to sleep with her. And Joseph was probably surprised by, I suppose, the directness of it, the sudden overture. And I'm guessing that in some sense, you know, it made him feel strangely good that someone important like that, and she was probably an attractive lady, I don't know, but, you know, had interest in him. But Joseph said no. And then the problem went away, right? Wrong. He did say no, but the problem surely didn't go away. Because that's how sensual temptation is. It's persistent. That's how it works. Even if you say no, let's say, as in you say no to pornography, guess what? That temptation will be there again and again and again and again. And you need to keep saying no. Verse 10 tells us that Potiphar's wife spoke to Joseph day by day. And the idea is day after day after day after day after day after day after day, even though he wouldn't listen to her, even though he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. She tried to get him to reconsider and to wear him down by sheer repetition of the idea, kind of the way, you know, the marketing and advertising industry does. It's just going to keep coming at you with this again and again. Or the way that, you know, you're looking at something on the computer and they're so smart now, they know what it is that you've considered that you need. And they want to put that in front of you, so you're going to run out to the store and buy it. And just keep putting things in front of us and wear down the resistance. Remember Samson? That's how Delilah brought about his downfall. Persistence. She eventually wore him down. And folks, temptation to sensual sin works that way. You know, 100 days of victory doesn't mean that on day 101 you're going to have victory again. It's persistent. And it's aggressive. The devil is aggressive. Billboards and advertisements are aggressive. The flesh is aggressive. In the final chapter here, Potiphar's wife hit Joseph with a sudden ambush, I guess we could say. And Joseph was either going to give in or he was going to flee. And she plotted it all out. She waited until he was alone in the house. Given Joseph's character, he was concentrating on doing his work and didn't even realize that the two of them were alone. Verse 11 says, "It came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house there within." You know, I'm thinking that had Joseph realized they were alone, he would have taken some precautions. You know, I don't think he knew, but she knew. Verse 12 says, "She caught him by his garment." In other words, she grabbed him by the coat and again said, "Lie with me." And the end of verse 12 tells us that Joseph left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. In other words, he just, you know, slipped out of the coat that was in her hand and ran outside and ran away as fast as he could. Now, folks, that's the way temptation works. You're vulnerable. There's a sudden surge of temptation that maybe catches you by surprise, maybe even flatters you. And even as you resist it, it's there again and again, day after day. Maybe there's pressure to get you to reconsider. Then maybe the sudden ambush where you hardly have time to think. It's just right there in front of you. What are you going to do? And at that moment, at each of those moments, you need to act immediately and decisively. If you're going to have victory over temptation, it has to be right now. It has to be absolute. It has to be decisive. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says that God will always make a way to escape, but He makes that way to escape with the temptation. That means you need to escape right then. The door is open then to flee from that temptation. But it won't necessarily be open if you hang around. Folks, don't toy with sensual sin. Don't turn it around in your mind. Don't take in just a little bit, telling yourself that, you know what, I can control it. Don't miss the chance to just say no. Because if you do, it's likely that you won't say no. I think I have told the story before of Lawn Chair Larry Walters, right? Some of you remember that? I don't know. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. It's worth telling again. It's a great story. True story, okay? July 2nd, 1982. Larry has this crazy idea. He gets himself some weather balloons, 42 of them to be exact. These are big old balloons, okay? And his lawn chair and a pellet gun. And Larry ties these 42 balloons filled with helium to his lawn chair. And it's tied down to the bumper of his Jeep. And his thought is, he's just going to kind of drift up there and hang out over the Mojave Desert for a little while and take in the sights. And then when he gets, when enough time has elapsed, he'll take his pellet gun and shoot some of those balloons and just kind of slowly drift back down to Earth. Seems like a good enough plan. And so Larry gets all set up, and there he is in his lawn chair, and the balloons are tugging up. And he finally, he looks to his friends, and he says, okay, you know, untie the rope to the bumper. And it was that instant that Larry realized that things were out of control. Because in a matter of minutes, he shot up to 16,000 feet. 16,000 feet, okay? He was spotted. No kidding. You can read about this. True story. He was spotted by the pilots of two commercial airlines because he was drifting into the controlled airspace of LaGuardia International Airport. That's LAX for those of you that speak airport, okay? And there he is. 15, 16,000 feet, yes, drifting around peacefully, right? In the middle of controlled airspace. Can you imagine the conversation those pilots had with the tower? Tower, I'd like to report there's a guy up here in a lawn chair. You know, I mean, I can't even say it without laughing, but, you know, I'd love to hear the recording. You know, and you know it's recorded somewhere. I'd love to hear that because it had, you know, the guys in the tower, what are you talking? Are you guys crazy? You know, what's going on up there? But finally, lawn chair Larry realizes he's got to come down somehow, so he courageously takes his pellet gun and proceeds to start shooting some of the balloons. At some point, he drops his pellet gun. Thankfully, he had shot enough balloons out that he was descending, and he gets caught in a bunch of power lines, causes a power outage for 20 minutes. They finally get him extricated from the power lines and get him down to Earth, and he is immediately arrested. And you can go read about it. They don't even know what to charge him with because nobody had ever imagined something so stupid, right? And in fact, they say that one of the police officers says, I don't know, he must have violated something with the FAA, so we're just going to arrest him and then we'll figure it out, okay? But here's my point in telling the story, other than that it's just a really amusing story, okay? Is lawn chair Larry thought he could control what was going to happen. And once you reach that point, when he cut the rope, you know, it was all out of control. And folks, we sometimes think that we can toy with temptation, with sensual sin, and play around with it just a little bit and kind of drift up and then come on back down and keep things under control. And the fact is when you do that, when you violate the teaching of 1 Corinthians 10:13, that you need to resist the temptation when it comes at that instant, immediately and fully and decisively. And when you bypass that opportunity and cut the rope, so to speak, there's no telling where you're going to find yourself. It might be 16,000 feet with commercial jets driving past. Even though you never thought, that's where things were going to end up. Temptation is persistent, and it's aggressive. And you've got to act immediately. And your decision in that instant is what determines whether you will be victorious or whether you'll fail. Because of that, this third principle for maintaining moral purity is perhaps the most important. Make a commitment to purity in an absolute sense. Complete, utter, completely, no little bit, just entirely. I'm going to maintain myself pure by God's grace and develop a strategy before temptation hits. You know, I don't think that Joseph's resistance was accidental or natural or spontaneous. I mean, in one sense it was, but he had obviously committed himself to purity and had something of a strategy in mind before he was confronted by it, especially in the really overt way by Potiphar's wife. And what I'm going to do is give you here a series of cautions, of considerations, without a lot of explanation. And maybe just jot them down, give them some thought on your own, but these are things that if we will, by God's grace, implement in our lives, they will help us to live a pure life, to be victorious over temptation towards sensual sin. First, be committed to integrity in all areas of life. You know, that's the story with Joseph. Four times in verses 4 through 6, we're told that all that Potiphar owned was in Joseph's charge, that he was absolutely and utterly trustworthy with Potiphar's money. And the fact is that integrity affects all of life. If Joseph had been cheating on business matters, it would have been easier to cheat with Potiphar's wife. Anytime there's adultery, there is deception. And if you are a characteristically deceitful person, then this is just one more aspect where that's going to play itself out. But if you'll make a commitment to integrity across the board in every aspect of your life, and it takes God's grace. I understand you can't just say that and it happens. But be honest with yourself. You know, do I shade the truth? Do I cheat on my employer? Am I deceptive and deceitful? And if you are, hey, start there. Deal with those things. We've got to be men and women of integrity if we're going to have integrity when it comes to sexual purity. And it'll be easier to be victorious if that's the way you customarily live. Keep your thought life pure. When Potiphar's wife surprised Joseph with her offer, he just said no. You know, if he had been regularly toying with impure thoughts, it's much more likely that he would have yielded. A lot of folks want to be delivered from temptation, but they'd like to keep in touch. And you've got to decide up front that you want to be morally pure in the most strict, absolute, complete sense. And it begins with confronting your lustful thoughts. I think I can say that this is a fact. No one ever committed adultery who didn't first entertain the thought in their mind. You know, all sin begins here. And then it leads outward through the body. C, focus on your responsibilities, not your needs. When Potiphar's wife propositioned him, Joseph didn't think about his needs. He pointed out his responsibilities toward his master and toward her and toward God. Look at verse 8. It says, he refused. And he said to his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house. In other words, he's just entrusted all this to me. He hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? If Joseph had been focusing on his needs and on his desires, then he could have built a case for giving in to the temptation. You know, maybe you'll find this helpful as you deal with temptation towards sexual sin on the thought level, which is where it always begins. You know, I would think along these lines. I am responsible as a Christian witness, as a father, as a husband, as a pastor. You know, even if you're single, right? You never sin alone. Your sin tarnishes the name of Christ. And if I remember those responsibilities, remember those relationships and the damage that would be done, and confront any lustful thoughts, it stops right there. But folks, as soon as you begin to entertain those thoughts and rationalize, well, I've got needs, you know, you expose yourself and others, those that you have relationships with, those that you are responsible to, you expose them to Satan's attacks. You know, if I fail morally, I'm failing my family, my church, my wife, I'm failing the lost, I'm failing God. And each of you has a circle of responsibilities like that, people that will be damaged, the cause of Christ that will be hindered, your walk with the Lord corrupted. So I've got to be responsible to judge my lustful thoughts, and so do you. D, don't rationalize lustful thoughts. These two are kind of connected. One commentator points out that Joseph's arguments for refusing in those two verses that we just read, verses 8 and 9, are the same that another man could have used for yielding. His master trusted him, so he was free from close supervision. No one would know. He had control over all matters in the household. Why not this one too? Then there are those men who would view intimate relations with a prominent woman like this as the path to social and political opportunity. Besides, she was his master's wife. If this is what she wants, shouldn't he submit to her? It's easy, folks, to rationalize sin in any of a thousand different ways. And you can take the same circumstances and you can construct arguments in your mind, if you will, either in favor of obedience to God or against obedience to God. And it all depends on your focus and on what you're aiming for. You've got to decide beforehand that you want to be a man or woman of God and that you will say no when temptations to immorality come, and they will come. Letter E, consciously live in the presence of God. Joseph was alone with Potiphar's wife there in the home, and in Egypt, far from his family. But Joseph wasn't alone. And he knew that if he gave in to temptation, he would sin primarily against God. David, after he did give in, said, against thee and thee only have I sinned. And that is certainly it is helpful to us to remind ourselves of our earthly relationships that will be damaged because of our wicked thoughts, because of engaging in something ugly and evil like this. But at the end of the day, the greatest reality is that it's an offense against God. Four times in this chapter, in verse 2, in verse 3, in verse 21 and 23, it says that the Lord was with Joseph. Now, I understand that the Lord is everywhere, right? He's omnipresent. He's with everybody, but that's not what we're talking about here. It means that God was with Joseph in a special way. There was a close relationship there. Joseph lived with an awareness of God's presence. He didn't want to trade that blessing for the passing pleasure of sin. And that's why he says, listen, you know what? I don't want to sin against my master, and I surely don't want to sin against God. He was mindful of what this would do to his relationship with God. Folks, you need to ask God to give you a continual sense of His holy presence. All sin is done in His sight, and all sin is primarily against Him. So if we covet God's blessing in our lives, we will fear Him and flee temptation. F, don't minimize the exceeding sinfulness of sin. In verse 9, Joseph calls, he says to Potiphar's wife, if I would do this, it would be great wickedness. It would be a sin against God. One of the ways that Satan gets to us, I think, is by swapping the labels on sin so that it doesn't sound quite so bad. How often in the press do you read about someone doing some great wickedness? They say, well, he had an affair or a fling. Makes it almost sound like something fun. When politicians apologize for their adultery, they'll call it an indiscretion, really, an indiscretion. A bad decision. A mistake. Folks, a mistake is what happens when you spell someone's name wrong, okay? When you commit adultery, it's not a mistake. It's selfish, twisted. It's a betrayal of your spouse. It's an evil offense against a holy God. And we do well to use biblical language in our thinking and in our words when we admit our sin, rather than kind of euphemizing it and softening it and making it seem like not such a big deal. When you're tempted, focus on the evil of the sin, not on its pleasure. All sin has its attractive side, or no one would ever succumb. Adultery, I suppose, has a certain desirability, but it also wreaks destruction and tears apart families and destroys relationships with God. Remember when Eve was tempted in the garden? She focused on the attractiveness of the fruit and the wisdom and the benefit that she thought they would get from it, and she fell. Joseph focused on the evil of adultery and stood firm. G, avoid the opportunity to be tempted. We read that Joseph hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. That's verse 10. And this relates to the upfront commitment to be pure. If you want to be pure and you know that someone or some place is maybe a place where you're going to be more vulnerable to temptation, then avoid that person or that place. Sometimes over the years in talking with young people, they've said, well, I don't want to be rude. And my thought is, I understand, we don't want to be rude people either, but better to be rude and pure, right, than friendly and impure. And you've got to be honest with yourself and honest about people that maybe are a problem for you. And there's no replacement for physical space. I'm just telling you that. Right? Up close and personal is far more tempting than 3 miles away. And sometimes we just have to say that, you know, for the sake of my purity, lest there would be any sort of temptation, lest there would be any sort of problem, any sort of vulnerability, let me be honest enough with myself that, you know what, this situation, this circumstance, this person pose a particular problem, and I need to just give it wide berth and stay away. Even if that means maybe being a little bit misunderstood. But we've got to avoid those temptations. If you're tempted with pornography, take steps to protect yourself from unprotected access to it. If a coworker is flirtatious, avoid him or her as much as possible. Don't lead them on by listening to them and smiling at them. Give strong signals that you're not interested. Lastly, flee when you need to. When Potiphar's wife finally went so far as to grab Joseph's coat, Joseph ran. You know, the Bible never says that we should stand and pray and quote precious verses when temptation hits. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee fornication. James 4:7 says, resist the devil. Okay, it says resist there. But 2 Timothy 2:2 says, flee youthful lusts. Someone has said those lusts aren't just for the youthful. You've got to flee them all of your life. Okay? And the fact is, folks, you won't yield if you're running the other way. So Joseph ran away, and God rewarded him for his righteousness, right? Well, in the end, yes. I mean, ultimately, yes. But it sure didn't seem like it. And that leads to the final step, the fourth principle needed to maintain moral purity in a polluted world. And this one's just brief. No subpoints, all right? Be willing to pay the price for your conviction. Potiphar's wife was humiliated when Joseph refused her advances, and her humiliation quickly turned to rage. One of the poets has said, heaven hath no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. And then we see that borne out in Potiphar's wife. And so she falsely accuses Joseph, and he ends up spending the next number of years. I don't know if we know, and if we do, I don't recall how long it was, but it wasn't an immediate release. He spends some time there in prison. Now, I would suggest that there's reason to think that Potiphar didn't believe his wife's story, because if he did, he probably would have executed Joseph that very day. He had the authority to do that. That would have been an understandable thing. No questions asked in that culture. Verse 19 says that Potiphar's wrath was kindled. In other words, his anger was burning, but it doesn't say that his anger burned against Joseph. You know, I think he was probably aware of his wife's flirtatious ways, and he was certainly aware of Joseph's integrity, but he had to do something. So he would lose a servant who had brought him great prosperity, but he couldn't let it slide. If he believed Joseph over his wife, you can imagine what life would have been like for him at that point. It's kind of like, you know, remember how Pilate yielded, you know, to the press to execute Jesus. I think Potiphar, kind of similar, yielded to the press of his wife to punish Joseph. Look at verse 17. Potiphar's wife says to her husband, the Hebrew servant, which thou hast brought unto us, came in unto me to mock me. Kind of like what Adam says in the garden, right? Well, God, it was the woman that you gave me. You know, I didn't really do anything. It's her, and really it's you because you gave. You know, and here it's Potiphar. The problem is you. You shouldn't have brought this guy here anyway, to mock me and to scorn me. Folks, because the world is so polluted, you can expect that you might have to pay a price when you take a stand for purity. You might be falsely accused. You might be slandered. You might be blamed for someone else's sin. You could lose your job. Joseph had plenty of time sitting in prison to kind of think things through and think about what he could have done if he had it to do over. Satan always comes to you after you've done the right thing and gotten stung for it and tries to say, hey, listen, next time just give in. You see, this didn't work for you this time. Folks, we've got to be willing to pay the price to stand for what's right. Willing to pay the price, whatever it may be, to keep ourselves pure. And the fact is, Joseph, even in prison, still had the presence of and blessing of God. And in verses 21 through 23, we won't go there for the sake of time, but it tells you that. I need to wrap this up. Folks, Joseph is a great example for us of a young man who recognized the vulnerability, who was committed to purity, who took the steps that were needed, including fleeing whatever the cost, in order to keep himself pure. I read that this may or may not be true, I don't know, but an old pastor was asked by a young man, "Pastor, when will I cease to be bothered by sins of the flesh?" And the pastor replied, "I wouldn't trust myself, young man, until I was dead for at least 3 days." Folks, the battle to stay pure in a polluted world is a lifelong war. But it is winnable if you'll be aware of situations where you're vulnerable and be on guard. Be aware. Understand how temptation works. Make a commitment to purity and have a strategy. Think about, you know what? What do I need to, what am I going to respond? Don't toy with sin, with impure thoughts, and be willing to pay the price. The purity in a polluted world has frankly cost many, many disciples of Jesus Christ. Now maybe you're here and you've already defiled yourself with sexual sin. Or maybe you are just currently ensnared by it. And I just want to say that Christ will deliver you and give you victory if you turn to Him, if you'll be honest with Him. No sin is beyond His grace. To every sinner who comes to Him, remember what He said to the woman taken in adultery? "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way and..." Paraphrase a little bit, "and from now on, sin no more." Right? If you're struggling, God is ready to forgive if you'll be honest. And if you'll be willing to submit yourself to some accountability so you don't sin anymore. And His answer is, there is rich forgiveness. There is God's grace. But let's not just come right back to it again. Let's go your way and sin no more. Let's have a plan in mind. Let's be committed to staying pure in a polluted world. Father, we are thankful.